What if I told you that sometimes a deal is too good to be true? Keep listening as we dive in. Welcome to the Money Meets Medicine podcast. We talk all about the personal finance topics you wish you had learned in medical school. I'm your host, Dr. Jimmy Turner. And here's your co-host who has real life nightmare stories of physicians getting burned in private practice partnerships as a physician contract attorney, Michael Johnson.
Too many to say. We're going to share some examples in this podcast today, but I'm excited about this topic. I'm a business owner. This is something that is near and dear to my heart, and I really want folks to understand how pre-ownership track stuff works. So let's dive into that today.
Yeah, I'm excited to chat about this because physicians in many specialties, ownership is a big deal, right? For some specialties, it's not as prevalent or as prominent. But when you have the opportunity to do private practice partnership or to buy into real estate involved in your practice, it can provide autonomy, wealth creation, real estate opportunities, and really a lot more. But ownership can also be something that people make a lot of mistakes with, to be honest with you. It's highly misunderstood. This is something that's not taught in medical school. There's no business of medicine class in the majority of medical schools out there. There are some exceptions. But sometimes if you're not particular, there's vague promises and things sound really good, but they don't really materialize. And so we're going to talk in this episode about breaking down how to evaluate private practice partnership opportunities, owning real estate as a partner, particular benefit of owning a surgical center, which I found interesting. I know we'll chat about that today. And even we'll touch on private equity buyouts and how to spot red flags when considering a partnership. If you stick around to the end, Michael, you've promised to share with us 8 questions every physician should ask when evaluating these kinds of partnerships or buying opportunities. So I'm super excited about that. Before we do, don't forget, longtime listeners know, I believe in disability insurance. It's the number one financial task for doctors. We can teach you everything you want to know about creating wealth through private practice partnerships like we'll chat about in this episode or paying off debt, but there is no money to invest or pay down debt if you become disabled and you don't have disability insurance. So make sure you check that box, get your disability protected by going to moneymeetsmedicine.com/disability, where we would be more than happy to help you at Money Meets Medicine Disability Insurance. All right, Michael. So let's start with actually a story of my own. So in my almost 10 years working in academic medicine, I tended to obviously be the go-to attending like residents would come to about contracts and potential job offers after residency and personal finance stuff and investing, paying off debt, you name it. Since I worked in anesthesia and still do, it was pretty common for me to get questions from residents who were thinking about joining a private practice on what they call a partnership track. That's what it's called typically in the anesthesia landscape. So like a 2-year partnership track or a 3-year partnership track. Sometimes there's a 1-year partnership track. And it goes by lots of names. Some people call it junior partner, tier partnership track, that sort of stuff. But Money Meets Medicine, I obviously get to know people through this endeavor as well. Emails, that sort of thing. People reaching out on Instagram through my DMs, which is blowing up at this point, and ask about other things like buying into practices and where they may even end up owning some real estate as part of that. So surgical centers being the example we said we're going to chat about. But I guess what I'm saying is that physicians hear the word partnership a lot. I'm not sure that they exactly understand what that means. So what does partnership actually mean to a physician contract attorney, maybe from your perspective?
Yeah, very good. So in the law world, partnership, ownership, these words have very specific meanings, okay? In medical world, the term partner might mean that someone who is your equal, who you work with regularly, your coworker, someone that you work with. But what we're really thinking about here is who owns the business. A partner might be someone who works with you, but might not be an owner, okay? If you say ownership, we're talking about ownership, that is really the important piece, okay? Are we moving towards owning a portion of this business, or are we moving to partnership in name only, which is more like a potential raise, maybe a better title within the company, within the business, but does not come with the ownership risks and benefits of the practice? Is really important to nail this down on the front end. I've had folks that have gone into private practice that there's been discussions about a partnership track, but didn't know to ask the question, what does partner actually mean? Explain it to me like I'm 5. I'm a resident or fellow. No one trains me on this. Can you explain this to me? They just didn't have the guts or didn't know to ask that question. And they realized that the current owners of the business had no intention of selling any portion of that business to them, but they were going to give them a title and maybe a small increase in compensation, but that's not really what they expected. That's not what they blood, sweat, and teared over their first 2 or 3 years for. So that is a really important thing to nail down first.
Yeah, so this goes back to my days as a philosophy major where terms are so important because you can have a conversation about religion or philosophy or politics or you name the subject. And it's interesting to me that oftentimes people will be using the same words and they'll mean it differently. And so they'll come to this conclusion in the conversation that they agree to disagree, or maybe that they agree, just to find out that because they were using words in different ways, they actually don't land on the same side that they would if they had used those things and those terms and defined them appropriately. And so when I introduce myself at work, it's hilarious because you know this because you helped me with my contract. I'm a 1099 doc now, and I'm talking to patients, and maybe I'm taking over care for somebody, and it's one of the partners in the group. There's five partners in my group, and there's a few of us that work part-time. And so at Wake, I would have said, hey, I'm taking over for Dr. Tom, one of their partners, and it had a certain meaning. But because I'm a businessman and I'm an entrepreneur outside of medicine, I know what that word means, and it has very specific connotations. And I'm definitely not a partner. I'm not planning to become a partner. I will never become a partner in that group. And so I always say I'm taking over for my colleague because
my colleague.
Exactly. Because I'm avoiding that term because it does have very specific connotations from a business standpoint.
Yep.
But you're right. A lot of doctors just use that term colloquially and say, hey, this is my partner at work. And it's like, yes, but in a business sense, that's probably not true. But maybe we need to break it down a bit then. And let's start with maybe assuming the partnership involves actually becoming a partner in the business, owning something of it. And let's talk about the pre-partner period, because this is what I see commonly in anesthesia. And I know this is true for other specialties too, but a graduating resident or someone who's thinking about changing jobs, is both of them are oftentimes in the situation where they're considering a W-2 employed position and potentially this partnership opportunity that might have 1 to 2 to 3 years out front before you become a partner. So an example that I've seen in my world is somebody that has a $500,000 W-2 offer on the table, and they have a 2-year junior partner track on the table where they're going to become a partner. Actually, you have the opportunity, this is important, to become a partner in 2 years, but they're going to pay them $350,000. And so it's $150,000 difference, $300,000 over a couple of years. And for those that don't have business experience, this seems really strange because you're like, I don't understand why I'm taking this massive pay cut. I'm supposed to make more money in business and partnership. And so for me, I learned this from the money meets medicine side of things. If we went on Shark Tank and I said, hey, I want to sell you 10% of my business and it's going to cost you $300,000, I'd be saying that I'm valuing my business at $3 million. You give me $300,000, you get 10%, and then maybe pay half now, half in 12 months. But in a partnership track coming out of graduating residency, they have no money. So you don't have the ability to just, which this is a question I've asked you in the past, has everybody just ever just fronted the money? But let's talk about physicians, graduating residents, comparing those two offers. So if we bring that back to the medical world for a physician considering a partnership track, what would they be getting for this significantly lower salary in those first 2 years?
I think one important consideration is looking at this big picture long-term. Okay, I'll have clients that have two offers like that in front of them, and they're looking just directly at the hospital employed position because it pays a higher signing bonus, it pays a higher guaranteed salary on day one. But often when we do a little bit of math and we learn what the owner, total owner remuneration is from the entire business, and we realize, oh, it's double or significantly higher what the hospital employed position will pay long-term, then you get like an indifference curve, right? You say, okay, a little bit less initially, I'm going to buy in, pay something, but then my earnings long-term are going to be 1.5x of what is typical for hospital employed. So I'll cross over around 7, 8, 9 years. But if I stay long-term, then it's more valuable. During the first couple of years, you're probably paying in some sweat equity. I'm using air quotes here with my fingers if you're not watching, but that is okay. I'm accepting a little bit less income in the short term because this offer of ownership is potentially on the table in the future. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that is a good bet. It's a good risk benefit because the advantage of ownership is very attractive. So first, we had a couple of variables there, right? So one is how much less are you earning compared to a hospital employed position? And then two is how long is that track to ownership? Is it 1 year, 2 years, 3 years? How long of a time are you making less than what you would otherwise make? And then third, you got to think, okay, what is the odds that they're actually going to hold up their end of the bargain? Okay, because it's not going to be 100%. Okay, no physician contracts and pre-ownership are ever going to guarantee you an offer to ownership at some time point in the future before they work with you. They always have to work with you before they sell a portion of this business to you. I just never see it really the other way except for one or two outliers. Okay. But you add up those three variables, how much less am I making? How long am I making less? And then what is the odds of ownership that's going to give you some starting things to consider. Fourth piece here is how much are they making? And if you can do that math, you can start to figure out whether the juice is worth the squeeze. But that's a really good start. And then getting that clarity on the front end can be really challenging, right? Physicians really don't like to talk about money and don't talk about business. I realize I'm preaching to the choir here. You know this. But, and then residents and fellows coming out, they get concerned about asking these questions.
Okay.
But I'm sure you have some thoughts about that.
Oh, man. So it's funny because residents nowadays have two different shticks, if you will. And so, and I'll say I know this from experience with a variety of groups that I know or have been involved in or friends of mine, where they will have graduating residents reach out and basically say something insane. The anesthesia market's really hot right now. And so they'll be graduating anesthesia residency and say, I want immediate partner in what partners make right now. And it's like that blunt, that forward, that direct. And obviously they never get a second phone call, like ever. Yeah. That's just not a reasonable thing. You clearly know nothing about business if you're having that ask. And then you have other people who know nothing about business. And the result of that ends up being that they're scared to ask questions and they don't really make their desires known. And so it's hard for the group to know, hey, are we going to be able to make this work? Are we providing something for you that meets your objectives and goals and desires? And are you going to be able to provide us something that meets our objectives, goals, and desires? And this is something that you want to make sure marries, because I know we're going to talk about kind of long-term projections, like how do we do the math on this to make sure that financial decision for you, if you're taking a partnership track, that break-even point happens by a year that you think is reasonable and that is going to be significantly better after that break point, like how to determine that. But I'll tell you from experience, like when I started medicine, I expected to be working full-time in medicine for 20 or 30 years. Right? I loved medicine. It was just what I did. It was who I was, all sorts of stuff. And then the entrepreneurship bug bit Jimmy Turner. And it turns out that I really like business too. And so I have a foot in both worlds now and I love my life. But if I had taken a partnership track and done a 2-year partnership track and then been a partner, I cannot tell you the number of anesthesia groups I know, at least, where going part-time as a partner is not a thing. It's not possible.
Correct.
Because of profit sharing and the way that calls are split and just equity, I guess I could say in two different ways, equity in terms of money, but also equity in terms of, hey, you need to be taking the same number of calls and doing the same number of things and covering all the same sites as every other partner because you're a partner. That's what that means. And so for me, a partnership track would have been a huge mistake, turns out, yes, because I don't want to work 5 days a week in medicine. I don't want to be on Q4 call. And I know that about myself now, but when I finished, I didn't. And so long-term, you need to be thinking about the financial implications, but you also need to be thinking about what are your long-term goals and desires, because it may not just be a financial conversation.
It was the same in our house. When Allie was finishing training, it was summer of 2020. She is from Milwaukee. I'm from New Orleans area. Moving from New Orleans to Milwaukee is a little bit daunting, to be honest. I didn't know for sure. I like it here.
Culture shock.
Here. A little bit of culture shock. But I wasn't sure that I was going to like winters. Let's be real frank. And she wanted to take the type of risk, that pre-ownership track risk. I don't know if that would have made sense for us at that time, because we had a conversation. I said, look, I've never lived there. I've never lived above I-10. Okay. I don't know about winters. And I don't know if this is going to be a long-term fit for me. And she was comfortable with that. So going in with at least some percentage chance that I, as a spouse, would say, hey, I don't like it here. Like, we should move back south somewhere. Taking a pre-ownership track would have been a bit challenging, because if she had done it for, let's say, 1 to 3 years and we decided to bounce, psychiatry is a little bit not the best example here, okay? The financial advantages are maybe not the same as procedural-based specialties, but it was different. That might have been a lot of lost income very early on, which can be quite painful. So one of the things that I talk to folks a lot about when we're considering options, is this a place where you have roots, where you are confident that you and your partner want to stay long-term? If you tell me, like, yeah, I think this is like a 3 to 5 year place for us, but all of our family is in the Northeast or in the Southwest or whatever, then pre-ownership track might not be the best path for you. Okay. Also, if you have any plans of stepping away, of going part-time, of maybe your partner is also a physician and you're looking at it together, saying, hey, we might both want to do a 0.8 FTE and make plenty of money and be very happy and enjoy 10 weeks off per year and do that together. Probably not going to be the case in the vast majority of private practice ownership situations. So understanding at a very early period in life and career what you want to do long term. That is a risk that is baked in here.
Yeah, it is. And honestly, it reminds me of a couple of things. One is the marshmallow experiment, where you get a marshmallow and then they leave the room with the kid and they say, hey, if you don't eat this for 20 minutes, when I come back, I'm going to give you a second marshmallow. That's like what private practice opportunities are. They're saying, hey, we're going to delay eating the marshmallow so that we get more marshmallow if we wait a couple of years. That said, during that couple of year period, there's two things that are happening. There's a tryout that you're taking place in for the practice where the partners are trying to decide, is this someone that we really want to add to the family here? Or are you the kind of person that turns out you're lazy, you don't put the work in, you make a ton of excuses, you're always late, you don't really help out with business meetings and conversations that we're having, you just want to get paid a paycheck? That's someone you don't really want to be a partner.
Correct.
You are also trying out the partnership where maybe 6 months in, you're like, hey, this is not the job that I thought it was going to be. I don't enjoy this. And so I'm going to exit this thing and I'm going to go pick up a W-2 job, or I'm going to go try another partnership in a different location for a different practice, because you are both evaluating each other in that situation. And so it's important to consider that. But let's say that they're thinking through this $300,000 gap that we just talked about in the example earlier. They can make $500 or $350 a couple of years. They're going to be $300,000 down by doing that partnership track. Determining that break-even point. I know that in the business world, for example, there's earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, amortization, or net cash flow. Basically, taking the profit of a business and saying, hey, based on your trajectory, this is what we think it's going to grow to. So we're going to multiply your net profits by this number. And that's what we think the business is worth. And then you can evaluate, okay, for your $300,000, this is how much of the business you're getting. But how does that work for medical practices? You take this $300,000 pay cut, if you will. How do you do the math on really like getting into the nitty-gritty details of figuring out where is the break-even and is this thing worth it?
Yeah. So from our side, there's a bit of soft analysis, okay? It's not always a perfect math problem, but I would say one key piece is understanding, generally speaking, how much the owners are making. Kind of need to know something about this to be able to evaluate the full picture. This should not be your first question during the interview process, okay? You got to be a little bit tactful here. Maybe it's better to bring up the discussion after a couple meetings, after you're in person, maybe during the dinner, maybe there's a glass of wine involved. Maybe it's like, hey, I literally like it here. I really want to understand long-term, big picture, what this looks like. First, can you help me understand what you need to see from me to be deserving, to be eligible for co-owning this business with you? Can you help me understand what you need? And they'll talk, okay, and you'll gain important information. And then two, you can say, okay, I see that there's a two-year path. Is that a hard two-year path? Is this more about the financial side? Is it more about when we both decide the right fit is? Can you tell me about timeline? Mostly it's about money and fit. It's not really about timeline. I see a lot of opportunities to shorten the timeline if you ask the right questions and you make this part of the discussion during the interview process. Okay, there's an opportunity there. If you are interviewing to actually help you make more money earlier and cut down on your initial losses, okay, if you bring it up. But that conversation gets them thinking, okay, one, they understand what the actual situation is. They're not here just looking for a paycheck and a signing bonus. They're looking at this long term, which one, you shouldn't think. That should be what you are thinking, but asking that question is really good. The next piece, okay, after those two questions have been discussed thoroughly, is most naturally, can you help me understand what the long-term financial prospects, what does this look like? Can you give me a feel for what the practice owns, what it will ultimately cost ballpark for me to become a co-owner, and then what the total owner remuneration potential looks like here? And you can even throw in, look, I understand that there's up years and down years, and it depends a bit on my individual volume at times, but can you give me a full picture? And if you have all of that, now you have better information, okay? It would be ideal if the business as a pre-ownership, not an employee yet, but evaluating an employment contract, would be better if they sent you all their P&Ls and their balance sheets. Occasionally, I get that. There's probably 10, 15% of practices where we'll get that information and we can help you understand directly how profitable the business is currently. I really like it when businesses do that. Often I do more selling than the business does if the financials are good.
Sure.
If you're, I realize I'm getting long-winded, but if you are a business owner and you want to win more in the pre-ownership track and you have really good long-term financials, okay, if that prospect has an attorney that knows what they're doing and you confidentially send them some financials, you really help them understand exactly what this looks like, and it's a very attractive opportunity, I promise you, dollars to donuts, you're going to win that interview process more often. But that's a starting point.
Longtime listeners of Money Meets Medicine know that I don't recommend other businesses or services lightly. And that's because this entire platform was built out of my desire to prevent others from being harmed like I was by bad advice and bad actors in the financial space. This is one reason I say no to over 95% of pitches that I get for advertising and sponsorships on Money Meets Medicine. But some partnerships are no-brainers, like recommending the same company that I use in my own personal life. For example, working with Gelt for my tax strategy is set to save my family more than $40,000 per year in taxes compared to my old CPA, who only touched base in February or March each year. Gelt, on the other hand, is a proactive, tech-forward tax strategy company, and I could say, from experience, that their customer service is incredible. So if you're a locum stock or a practice owner, partner getting a K-1, surgery center owner, or maybe you're a W-2 physician with a 5 or 6 figure side income, you need more than a CPA who just checks in February or March. You need a modern CPA firm built for business owners and high-earning professionals with a strong specialization in physicians. Summer is the easiest time to switch, and Gelt is built for that transition. Dedicated tax strategists, real human expertise, technology doing the grunt work in the background. To make it even more of a no-brainer than it already is for the docs that fit that bill, Money Meets Medicine has partnered with Gelt to offer a 10% discount on your first year services when working with them. Head over to moneymeetsmedicine.com/CPA to schedule a call and get that 10% discount when you do so. Now back to the show. Yeah, I think I'll make a couple comments. One is that the art of negotiation is letting someone else have your way, right? Kind of a classic quote in the negotiation world. And the way that you do that, in my experience, is by asking lots of questions. And it's interesting because questions do a lot of things for you. One is it gives you information, as you just mentioned. Second, it shows that you have some business knowledge, which as a partner in a partnership, they want you to have business experience or at least know what's going on. You don't need to have an MBA, don't get me wrong. But you asking insightful questions shows that you get it, right? Like you're someone that's going to be helpful in these conversations. It also makes it clear that you are the kind of person that they're going to like, because it turns out humans like to talk. And so when you ask questions, it gives someone else a chance to talk about them or their business or their family or whatever is important to them. And the more that you let someone do that, the more likely they are to actually like you. And so you have done so much for yourself by getting more information, by showing the kind of business partner you'll be, by showing that you're a likable human being because you care about other people and their interests, and you haven't given them any information. And so it's an amazing thing in a negotiation that you can actually have those conversations where the other person comes away thinking, wow, this is a really wonderful human being I'd like to work with. And they know nothing about what your goals are. They know nothing about what you're driving toward because they were the one talking because you asked so many questions. And so this really proves beneficial. But when it does come time to flip and really kind of get to brass tacks and know the numbers, think through those numbers, I'll say that in my own experience changing jobs, there are other recent graduates that were reaching out for the same job that I was applying for. And the comment that was made to me multiple times was, it is so refreshing to talk to someone who knows what they want and has reasonable requests. And so what that means is I was actually saying, hey, in order for this to work for me and my family, I need these things. And if that's not going to happen, that's totally fine. But it's better for both of us if we sort that out at the beginning so that we know if this is going to be something that can work. And for them, it made it very easy for them to say, yeah, actually, that's a really good question. We can actually make that work. That's something we haven't done before, but there's no reason we couldn't, as opposed to just having this very nebulous, I want to make lots of money and come work at a job that is easy, or whatever way it came across for other people that had less experience. But because I knew what I wanted and I made it clear after lots and lots of questions and understood what the group was and what they were about, it made it easier to encourage that conversation. I will say, though, it is my experience, you have much more of this than I do in this realm, but that people are very guarded about the books. Like you have to, it's almost like you have to cross a certain commitment threshold before they will actually talk to you about the partnership. And for example, as a 1099 doc at the group that I work at, I don't know anything about the books. I know nothing about the books. I would never ask for that because that's not my, I shouldn't have that information. I'm a 1099 doc, right? It seems like there's a threshold you have to cross. You take them on enough dates and then finally you can pop the question, right? Sort of thing. But for you, what normally needs to get checked off those boxes before someone's willing to divulge the books, you can actually have a conversation about those numbers?
Yeah. So during the interview process, first, I think that physicians and the practice need to make sure there's a relationship fit, and then there's a clinical practice fit. If their practice is doing things that is not your interest, then I don't care how much money is involved. Like, it's probably not going to work out. It might not be as attractive as a long-term opportunity. Okay. So that kind of needs to be the first piece. And then understanding kind of big picture goals and objectives of the practice and of the physician, having those personal conversations about long-term career goals and objectives, I think is next. But I think that if practice owners feel confident that you are really seriously considering them, this isn't just another opportunity to travel and be wined and dined a bit, and you're one of five different options. If they feel confident that you are taking them very seriously, then I think they are more open to sharing the financial pieces. Okay. And often the most common path here is sharing general numbers verbally. I would love to know all of the P&Ls and the balance sheets. And if someone sends that to me, like, I'm subject to confidentiality, like I can't share it with anybody. It's safe. It's okay.
Sure.
And practice, if you're a practice owner and you're like, Michael, you're crazy, why would I ever let that go? You can protect yourself through an NDA. Mm-hmm. Plenty of times where my client will sign an NDA before looking at any specific financials. And that is very strong. It's protective.
So for listeners, in case you don't know what that word means, that's a non-disclosure agreement.
But yeah, so there's an opportunity there. I think that one of the challenging pieces, and this happened twice in the last 6 months of my firm, okay? But one of the challenging pieces is when you go through the entire pre-employment, pre-ownership track, and then you get to the end and you realize the business is not what it seemed, not as attractive. It's not doing well. The owners are really not making any more than you, and they're facing other pressures that make becoming an owner unattractive. Maybe they have a legacy buy-in system that is very expensive that just doesn't match the financial advantage of becoming an owner. I see practices like that, particularly some that have been around for a long time that have really high valuations when you buy in. Okay, on top of the sweat equity that you've already sacrificed for the first 2 years, there's an additional buy-in to the practice that is relatively high. But the advantage of becoming an owner is just not that much greater than being employed with anybody else. And they're asking you to pay a bunch of money to get there. And I see that quite often, twice again this year, where they had to actually turn down ownership and walked out.
And
it'd be really nice. We're not going to be able to protect you in every single situation like that. Okay? But it'd be really nice if we can lower the probability of that happening on the front end through thoughtful questions and evaluation.
All right. So a natural follow-up question there is, how does someone spot red flags in a partnership track before that stuff happens, right? Obviously, if they sell you a bill of goods that, and I don't even know if there's any legal recourse, if someone sells you, okay, this is what the business is worth, this is what it's doing, and then 2 years later, you find out none of that was true. But let's not go down that road. Let's say, how can somebody considering a partnership opportunity spot some red flags that would say, this is probably not a partnership track that I should really consider?
So one is whether the last few folks that have gone through have actually been offered ownership and have accepted. And if they have evaluated it and then they say, no, this doesn't make sense for me, or if the partnership didn't offer it, then they better have a pretty good story as to why, because that recent history bias calls into question. I had one recently that they didn't know this answer when we were evaluating the employment agreement. And I said, you really need to get this answer. And then they did some digging and they realized two of the last three over the last 5 years actually turned down ownership because it was unattractive and they had reasons. You got to watch out for confidentiality if you were the one sharing the internal reasons why you didn't offer ownership. Okay, that's a whole other trick bag. But that's a really good place to start. Second place, I don't want to sound ageist here, but if you have, let's say you have five owners, and all of them are between 65 and 68, and you are the one coming on, I see a lot of risks with the ages being a bit lopsided. Okay, in an ideal world, let's say this five owner, you're going to be the sixth. There is one owner at each five-year period along the path so that when one comes in, one retires, okay, you buy out the one that's leaving, and then you bring in someone new shortly thereafter to consider the path again. That level of consistency over time, in my opinion, reduces a lot of risks. It reduces a lot of private equity buyout risks. Okay. If the owners in the practice don't believe that they can sell their portion to the next generation that's coming through the pre-ownership track, they're going to look at private equity and say, I got to stay here for 5 years because they got this 5-year no out thing, but I can do that. They're going to pay me some 7-figure number, maybe it's super attractive. And I'll just do that. Even if I bring on someone who's coming in pre-ownership, I'm just going to do that anyways.
So let's take a tangent and talk about that for a second, because this may be the most common conversation I have with residents and people about partnership tracks is they come back like, Jimmy, I love the job. It was great. I'm like, awesome. Tell me about it. And you're like, I'm taking this much call. This is the amount that I start at. This is, I don't know exactly what the partners make, or actually I'm probably not allowed to tell you, is usually the answer I get most of the time. And they tell me all these wonderful things, the amount of vacation they have, the area that it's in is perfect for the family because of X, Y, and Z. And I'm Debbie Downer, Jimmy always asks, hey, so what happens if they get bought out? And they're like, well, what do you mean? And I'm like, you have a 2-year partnership track or 3-year partnership track. What happens if private equity or a large hospital conglomerate, which is becoming more and more common, comes in and says, hey, we want to buy this practice. And they offer the partners $4, $5, $8, $10 million each to buy the practice. What's going to happen to you if you're 2 years into your 3-year partnership track? And like, oh, I don't know. They said there was no chance that they'd sell. I did ask that. And it's always such a, I think you and I have talked about this before, but it's always such an interesting and just easy conversation. As soon as they say that comment to me, I always say back to them, great, this is going to be super easy for you. What you need to do is you need to go back to them and say, hey, I've been thinking about this more. I'm so happy that there's no chance that you're going to sell because I had multiple partners tell me that. And so because of that, it should be really easy to add language into this contract saying that if it happens to happen, that the blue moon event does occur, that for every month of my 36-month partnership track, I'm going to get that percentage of a buyout from whatever the partners would get. And usually they'll be like, are they going to go for that? I'm like, if they told you there's no chance that they're going to sell, you just use those words back to them and say, since there is no chance, this is an easy add to the contract that gives me the ability to sleep at night and provide wonderful work for you. And it's no sweat off your back because it's not going to happen, right? And then you're going to find out one of two things. They were lying to you because they won't put it in. Or the second is that, and this is my experience, and you tell me if my N equals whatever is too low to have this opinion be correct. But most of the time they will come back and say, hey, I'm very happy with the changes that they added. They can't tell me because it's confidential now, but they don't want other people knowing that the group did that. But they usually come back and say, hey, you're right. They had no problem meeting me halfway.
No, you're right. And I think that seriously considering a private equity or hospital buyout related clause in your employment agreement about accelerating into ownership is really important. In a perfect world, you would have the veto power over any sale. Okay. That is kind of hard to get. Okay. Allowing an employee to come in and say, hey, I get to veto your sale. They're like, I'm going to terminate you without cause. You got 90 days. We'll vote on this in 91 days. So that can be very difficult. Okay. Second piece. Okay. The more common path for us when we're working with folks on this is to ask for a clause that says, if there is a transition in ownership, okay, don't just mention private equity or just hospitals because you could merge with another practice or something, okay? Broad transition in ownership, then because I am an employee, I have the right to accelerate into ownership and to participate as an owner, as an equal owner in an ideal world, in that sale, okay? So maybe you don't want to work for private equity, but it might be a good idea to at least be able to participate if this thing is already happening to
you. Have the option.
Okay. You've been working for a year and you got to sign a 5-year no out to work with private equity, but you're going to get a $3-4 million paycheck. You might at least want that option, which is better than not having it at all. Okay. So that's one piece. Another layer here is if there is a change in ownership, also having the option to exit, maybe with some sort of financial advantage. Okay, mm-hmm. Some sort of buyout of your employment, but it'll be able to exit with malpractice tail paid for, with no non-compete, with no non-solicit, no restriction on where you can practice, termination rights that are favorable for you, waiver of any signing bonus clawback provisions. The full gamut of all the exit strategy problems are in your favor now if they have some sort of change in ownership during your pre-ownership.
I just want to say that's actually a really wonderful point to make. And I don't know why my brain didn't go there, because this happened in Charlotte, North Carolina, where an anesthesia group, massive anesthesia group, got bought out. And because they didn't have language in that contract, all of the anesthesiologists were immediately unemployable in Charlotte because they had a non-compete.
Yes.
And had they had language like that in the contract, there were physician suicides. This ended up being a really big deal because just lives were completely changed overnight when corporate entity number one came in and bought corporate entity number two. And all of a sudden the contract didn't matter anymore, but they could no longer contract with a new entity. And so that opportunity to have an acceleration to ownership is fantastic, but at a bare minimum, having what you just described is some serious safety and ability to sleep at night. That's a really good point.
Yes. Something that we talk about and work on very regularly. And to your question of the small N, if this is normal, I think that asking that question, negotiating for some protections, if there is a change in ownership before you are an owner, their answer is very instructive. Okay. Very helpful. If they give it the thing to you, then great. Now you know that there is a measure of comfort, respect, measure of anticipation that this probably is less likely to happen. They're probably less likely to give this thing to you if they have already been talking about selling and they're halfway down the pipe. Okay. If they don't give it to you, then now you understand another measure of risk in taking this job. Okay. You just factor it into your variables of whether this job is better than taking another position. And that increases the risk. Either way, you are better off by asking that question. Obviously, with all of this, talk to your own lawyer. This is not legal advice. I should have done this in the beginning. There are always exceptions to the norm, but either way,
you have more information, which I think is really important. Two other things as we round this out, I do want to talk about, because one of them is something that I personally don't have a ton of knowledge about. It's just very vicarious knowledge, which is real estate as part of these opportunities, which is, I feel like, super common in the dental world, not as common in the physician world, but definitely still exists. And maybe make a specific comment on surgery centers and why those are kind of special.
So when you're evaluating all of the things that the practice owns, first, it's good to understand what is on the table. Not all practice owners are offering equal ownership in all entities of the practice. Okay, typically you have a couple different entities, particularly for proceduralists. You have the practice itself, okay, which is mostly the profits from your labor. You have the ambulatory surgery center. Hopefully you own a piece of that, okay? You have a real estate component, okay? Maybe the real estate houses the clinics. Maybe there's a separate real estate LLC that houses the ASC. That might be on the table. Sometimes there's another entity that houses ancillaries for various, like, Stark Law, anti-kickback details that we don't need to go into now, but sometimes the ancillary revenues that stream off the practice might be housed in a separate LLC, okay? So first is understanding what is owned by the practice. If you're a proceduralist, it is very valuable to have ownership in facility fees, okay? Facility fees is becoming a growing portion of the overall payment model, okay? Another big risk that I meant to mention earlier when I was talking about Aegis stuff, apologies, was if you're a proceduralist, but you don't have any access to the facility fee portion of the payment models, okay? If you don't have that, then you're a prime target for private equity buyout or hospital acquisition, becoming very difficult for us to evaluate a practice that is looking good to be successful long-term without that piece. Okay. So that is the initial framework. Looking specifically at real estate, okay? I like to think of this as, are you paying rent to a third party or are you paying down your own mortgage? Okay. Having a commercial real estate asset with a great stable tenant that pays their bills on time, which is you.
Which is you, yeah.
Which is you. Can be a very valuable asset to have. And let's use an example. Let's say that you're an ortho practice and you got multiple clinics, okay? You got $10 million in commercial real estate assets. You go to buy in and let's say that assets are valued at $10 million. Let's say the current mortgage on the property is $7 million. So you got $3 million. Okay. Let's say there you're becoming the sixth owner. So 3 divided by 6, 50. Okay. So you're paying $500,000 because you're buying that gap in equity, 1/6 of that gap in equity in this hypo, paying $500,000 to own 1/6 of that real estate asset. Think about where that might go in 20 years. $10 million real estate asset. I'm not going to guess that I understand anything about real estate asset valuations. Okay. But it's not crazy that it might be worth 20 or 30 million. Okay. That's not crazy. And over time, if you're paying down the mortgage, okay, it's totally possible that the mortgage is less than $700,000 in our hypothet. So then when you go to exit the business, now your gap there could be substantial. So your $500,000 investment might be significantly more. Also, it's more than just investing in real estate. So if you're thinking, Michael, I'm not a big fan of investing in real estate, that's not really the analysis here. Because at the end of the day, if some of the partners, some of the owners in the business are paying rent, okay, and the other owners are paying down their own mortgage, that can create some friction at times.
Sure.
So you think about the rental value of the property. The ones that own the building want it to be higher. The ones that are paying rent to a third party might want to be as low as possible. This can create some friction internally. So I encourage folks to seriously consider buying into the real estate asset and being a part of the entire picture.
Yeah, I think that's really important to consider. And maybe conceptually, just think about it like this. These are probably, to the conversation we had at the very beginning of the show about terms. Terms actually do mean something. But you hear about situations where there are unequal partners, super partners versus regular partners. And the super partners have access to all the different revenue streams that are in the practice. So maybe they have the real estate portion of it. Maybe they have the other sources of Stark Law revenue sources that come in through the business, but you're only going to be getting the clinical dollars from your labor as a surgeon when you become a partner. You're not really an equal partner in that business. You are some subset of a partner. You're like not a super partner or a big partner. You're a junior partner, like whatever term you want to use to describe it. And I think it's really important to know that. Like, what are you getting into on the back end? How can someone have a sense for that situation potentially happening, I guess is what I'm asking, because it doesn't seem like they would always be given that information up front and that they would eventually find out in some backdoor, maybe conversation that happens and they realize, oh my gosh, there's all this revenue coming in that I never even knew about that I don't have access to, which seems like a terrible situation to be in.
It's hard to realize that 2 or 3 years in after you've given up a couple $100,000. I think it goes back to that conversation that we hypothesized over the second glass of wine during the steak dinner at the kind of inn when you have the brass tacks of the financials. It can also be helpful if there is some sort of email discussion, maybe sometimes something in the contract actually about what an offer of ownership is anticipated to look like. Okay, sometimes we can get language in that speaks to the ownership offer always being optional for the practice, but if it is offered, it shall be equal ownership share amongst all owners and shall be valued in a certain way that is spelled out in the contract. I see that sometimes and I like it, whether it's attractive or unattractive, maybe we can quibble about what the valuation is or whatnot, but I'd like clarity that is upfront and honest from the get-go, okay? Another piece here is that yes, it is always a risk on your side as the pre-ownership track employed physician that they might change their mind down the road. Okay. It's July when we're recording this, probably coming out August or something. If you're evaluating an opportunity for starting in 2027, that offer of ownership might be coming 2030, this 4 years out. So a lot can change in 4 years. So sure. I don't think it's realistic to say, hey, whatever they told me is completely locked in and guaranteed. There's always going to be some risk that they change their mind, but that's really the best that we can do.
Got it. I love that. As we round out the show, why don't you list off those 8 questions? We've talked about a lot of them throughout the show already, but what are the 8 questions for that simple framework people can use to evaluate ownership opportunities as we kind of summarize things maybe through these 8 questions you have?
Very good. So first is the pre-ownership track employment compensation. You shouldn't eat ramen noodles, shouldn't be on pure productivity, but you should be treated reasonably. It's going to be something less than hospital employed in most situations, okay? Second is the length of time to ownership. 1 to 3 years, sometimes a little bit longer in certain specialties than others, but I've seen 7 years for an ophthalmologist. What's going on? Why is this necessary? So make sure you understand what is normal for your specialty and it is within reasonable market norms. So that's 2. Number 3 is, what is the history of them offering ownership? Is it a batting average or everybody except for that one person 10 times ago that they started coke in the bathroom and had a fire, okay? Is it everybody except for that person, okay? It's really important. 4th is what you are going to have access to buy, okay? 5th is, what are you going to pay to buy those assets? 6th is what are the owners making by currently owning those assets? Okay. If you understand that, you got a really good picture. Number seven here is think about private equity or hospital acquisition, merger acquisitions, risk. Can you protect yourself in that situation? And then eight, you also might want to leave this, okay? There's no guarantee that you actually want to become an owner at the end of this. So you need to think about your exit strategy. All the bread and butter stuff that we've already talked about, we'll continue to talk about your non-competes, your non-solicit clauses, your termination right, malpractice tail coverage, callback and waiver issues. What are the restrictions to be able to leave? So you line up these eight issues, and before you sign, you have a measure of clarity, as much as you can get, around these eight issues, and you can make an informed decision. Hey, you are ahead of the game. That is going to be, on average, leading to better outcomes for you. And if you miss on some of those, you might regret it at the end.
I love those eight questions as a framework and how to think through this. So love having you on. As always, it's been a little while since we've done an episode like this. There are several other episodes you can go and check out if you are interested in hearing more of Michael's takes on physician contracts as a physician contract attorney and someone who's also married to a physician. So he gets it for two different reasons. As you head out, don't forget, you can snag a free copy of The Physician Philosopher's Guide to Personal Finance, a book I wrote for physicians in training and for early career attendings. If you want to get started on your financial literacy journey, go over to moneymeetsmedicine.com/freebook where you can snag your copy. As always, everybody, thanks for hanging out. Appreciate you being here, and thanks for sharing the show with your friends. Cheers.
Justin Harvey is a certified financial planner at APM Wealth, where he helps anesthesiologists and pain medicine physicians. Dr. Jimmy Turner is a practicing academic anesthesiologist at Wake Forest in North Carolina. He's also a licensed insurance agent. However, either Justin or Jimmy are your financial planner, investment advisor, or insurance agent. This show is expressly for general education and entertainment purposes only. Nothing should be considered financial advice. All views expressed are solely the views of the guests on the show and do not represent the views or opinions of their employer.
Justin Harvey is a certified financial planner at APM Wealth, where he provides financial advisory services for physicians and their families. Dr. Jimmy Turner is a practicing anesthesiologist in North Carolina and a licensed insurance agent. However, neither Justin nor Jimmy is your financial planner, investment advisor, or insurance agent, and nothing discussed on this show creates that kind of relationship. This show is expressly for general education and entertainment purposes only, and nothing should be considered financial, investment, insurance, tax, or legal advice. The views expressed by the hosts and any guests are solely their own and do not represent the views or opinions of their employers, and their appearance on the show does not constitute an endorsement of their services. Before making any financial decisions, of course, consult your own financial, tax, or legal professional who understands your individual situation.